Welcome to the podcast component of ArmageddonLetters.com, a virtual time machine back to the moment the world was nearly destroyed in late October of 1962. You can also follow us on Twitter at ArmageddonTweet. I'm Jim Blake.
And I'm Janet Lang. The Cuban Missile Crisis happened a half century ago, and it all began at the Bay of Pigs in Cuba in April of 1961. When a group of Cuban exiles invaded the island, thinking that they would be the wedge that would lead to an uprising that would overthrow Fidel Castro. Instead, the Cuban militia responded very well, and within 72 hours, the invasion was over. It has been called, certainly from the U.S. side, a perfect failure. Not easy to get a perfect failure.
Well, it perfectly describes the American viewpoint with regard to the Bay of Pigs, because, of course, the Cubans regard it as a perfect victory, not a perfect failure, a perfect success. The phrase comes from Theodore Draper, who wrote a book on the Bay of Pigs the year following, 1962, called The Perfect Failure. Now we might call it a perfect storm. That's a popular term after a popular book published a few years ago. You had a very young, very inexperienced president. He was a senator, not a governor. He'd never actually governed anything. It's one of the problems that senators have when they become presidents. They really don't know how to run anything. So there's that. He was totally intimidated initially by Eisenhower, his predecessor's reputation. The guy was the head of all Allied forces in Europe that beat up on the Nazis and won the Second World War as it was fought in Europe. And then he was a president for 8 years. And on the 17th of March, 1960, in his last year in office, he signed a piece of paper authorizing preparations for an invasion of Cuba and for the assassination of Fidel Castro, Raul Castro, Che Guevara, and all the other members of the Cuban leadership. Kennedy found out about this in December after he was elected at a briefing by Alan Dulles down in Palm Beach, where he had one of his homes, and he was shocked. But he also didn't know kind of what he was doing. Covert operations was nothing that he had any experience with. Another contributor to the perfection of this failure was that he had intelligence advisors at the CIA who thought they could kind of cuff him around. All they had to do was to put a few Cuban exiles on the beach, scream bloody murder, send in the Marines, and then establish a radio station, call it Radio Free Cuba or something, and say, oh, we're here, we want to start a democracy, and Kennedy would have to send in regular U.S. forces in order to sort of win the war for our guys, for our Cubans instead of their Cubans. These CIA director Alan Dulles, but particularly the deputy director Richard Bissell, really thought that he could entrap Kennedy. He could snare him.
The plan starts out very big, almost like, let's say, a five-course meal. And then Kennedy sort of keeps saying, I don't want to do that much. I don't want to do that much. So they get it down and down and down. And it basically, by the time it's sort of approved, it's sort of a side salad. And the CIA actually goes along with that, even though they think the side salad alone certainly can't do it, because, as Jim said, they believe they can force Kennedy to bring in the Marines. Kennedy has told them directly
he's
not going to do that, but they don't believe him. So, in a sense, with sort of delusion on both sides, the Bay of Pigs proceeds with this salad-like operation, and Fidel just wipes it out. I mean, it is really not a huge amount of energy, frankly, to really squash this thing, because it's not much. Even though the big U.S. forces are close by, but Kennedy, in real time, he says, "I'm sorry, I'm not sending in the U.S. troops," and the CIA can't believe it. I mean, they really are apoplectic.
That's
right. Part of the deal.
Well, I mean, not only were they apoplectic, they lied through their teeth. They landed in a place, the Bay of Pigs, Playa Heron Beach, that's 40 miles from anything like open country, and the hills in which supposedly they would fade away as guerrillas. it's 40 miles of swamp. It is uninhabitable, even by Cubans. There's nobody there, and they can't go anywhere. The boats start sinking. The bullets don't show up. They don't have an air force. It's just a horrible mess. It's too big to disguise and way too small to succeed. That's part of the perfect failure. And we shouldn't ignore here the Cuban achievement in figuring out where this landing was going to be, because everybody knew that something was coming, and getting from Havana, which is where all the leadership was, down to the Bay of Pigs in this horrible mess, this swamp, and they fought like hell.
Kennedy reluctantly lets this operation go through within, you know, days, hours, really. It's clear it's not going well. The Soviet Union has been informed of this action, and they go bananas. They are a supporter, a patron of the Cuban government, and Khrushchev sends Kennedy one heck of a angry letter. How dare you, Mr. President? Kennedy gets this letter from Khrushchev just about the same time that essentially people are saying, it's over. I mean, we have no chance of pulling this thing off. Done deal. His early reaction is anger. But he's also just, like, really angry of the situation that he's in. And what's interesting is the letter that he immediately writes back to Khrushchev, which is dated April 18th, 1961, and it does appear in our book, The Armageddon Letters.
Letter number five.
It's totally different from the other letters that Kennedy and Khrushchev have written before and will write later. Kennedy typically has a very diplomatic, curt, short, to the point.
Kind of lawyerly.
Non-emotional kind of tone to his letters. This one, there's energy in the letter. Officially, Kennedy had sort of tried to make sure that it wasn't an official U.S. invasion. And in a very explicit way, it wasn't. He never let the U.S. troops go there. But all of the Cuban-American exiles were trained by the CIA. I mean, it was a CIA operation.
They took some U.S. Air Force planes and repainted them so as to fool the world that these weren't U.S. planes. What happened? One of them actually made it back to Miami, and when it landed, the paint fell off, and it revealed the stars and stripes of the United States of America as if it really needed to. But, I mean, that's how slipshod, that became a symbol of the slipshoddiness of the whole operation.
But Kennedy, he sticks to that narrow definition of it is not a U.S. operation since there are no U.S. Combat troops. So he states this rather directly to Khrushchev, who I'm sure doesn't believe a word that he's saying. But anyway, this is what Kennedy says. I've previously stated, and I repeat now, the United States intends no military intervention in Cuba. But in the event of any intervention by an outside force, we will immediately honor our obligations under the inter-American system to protect this hemisphere against external aggression. Kennedy is saying, the invasion that looks like it's U.S., smells like it's U.S., quacks like it's U.S., well, it isn't U.S. The other thing that Kennedy responds to is that Khrushchev has really tried to sort of stick his finger in Kennedy's chest and said, you know, you're doing dangerous.
Because he can't reach all the way up to his eye.
Yeah, he's a little short. he says, you know, you're really increasing world tension by this. You are being provocative. This could spread to other parts of the world. Back off, Kennedy. Call it quits. Leave Cuba alone. Well, Kennedy's response, I agree with you, Kennedy says, as to the desirability of steps to improve the international atmosphere. For example, a prompt ceasefire and settlement in Laos, cooperation with the United Nations in Congo. Oh, and by the way, the regime in Cuba could make a similar contribution by permitting the Cuban people to freely determine their own future by democratic processes.
I.e., free and fair elections monitored by the United States of America in which the U.S. candidate wins. I mean, that's the way it would be read around the world. This is not a letter that reflects the high intelligence and wit and savvy of the President Kennedy that we now know.
Two leaders really taking off their gloves and just sort of verbally punching it out with each other. So that's the immediate action, the immediate effect. within a couple days, though, in a sense, the full scope, burden of this perfect failure really descends upon Kennedy. We have some notes. There's a wonderful document by Kennedy's Assistant Secretary of State, Chester Bowles, who was at a meeting that occurred on April 30th. What he says is that this was, quote, about as grim as any meeting I can remember in all my years of government, and that is saying a good deal. He then describes President Kennedy. The president was really quite shattered, and understandably so. Almost without exception, his public career has been a long series of successes without any notable setbacks. And then he describes something. He says, the discussion simply rambled in circles with no coherent thought. And then finally, after 3/4 of an hour, the president got up and walked toward his office. So Kennedy is in a funk for a while, that's for sure. But he doesn't stay there very long.
Kennedy wants to know, how do we avoid this in the future? And another thing he wants to know is, who has got to go from my administration? Who is responsible? And he calls in an outsider, General Maxwell Taylor, who eventually will become his chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but at this point is called a special presidential military advisor. The Taylor Commission produces a document within 2 months that puts the fingers straight on the CIA. They were deceptive. They were insufficiently prepared. Kennedy uses this as an opportunity to do something no president before or after has ever done. He fired the head of the CIA, the only director the CIA had ever had, Allen Dulles. It was founded after the Second World War. Allen Dulles is gone, and Richard Bissell, who's the deputy director for operations, like the Bay of Pigs operation, he's gone. Bissell seemed to be the heir apparent to Dulles, and Dulles was the grand old man of the CIA, and this 43-year-old guy who let this go forward was determined not to let it happen again, and he got rid of the two top intelligence officials in the United States government.
The other thing that Kennedy did, and he's a very busy person in the couple weeks after the Bay of Pigs, he asked his national security advisor to essentially give him an honest appraisal of all the mistakes that were made. And Bundy, McGeorge Bundy, writes a beautiful memo outlining a number of things. But one of the main things that he puts in there is, quote, the president and his advisors must second guess even military plans. So he's reminding Kennedy to not just sit passively whenever there are military or CIA plans. Get active in there, question them, and so forth. It's a lesson that Kennedy imbibes in his bones. He will never, ever be as passive as he was in the Bay of Pigs. The other thing that Kennedy is very interested in is he is an internationalist. And so he actually cared about what the opinions were of his three European partners, England, France, and Germany. And so he sends Arthur Schlesinger over there to interview the leaders of those countries and their other senior people and to ask them their views, their reactions to the Bay of Pigs. And then he comes back and he writes an incredibly honest and brutal memo to Kennedy. Now, it takes a certain president to ask for and tolerate and appreciate critical, brutal memos. So in this memo, Schlesinger says, the first reactions to Cuba were, of course, acute shock and disillusion. After Cuba, the American government seemed as self-righteous, trigger-happy, and incompetent as it had ever been. Quote, Kennedy has lost his magic, one person said. Schlesinger says, by the way, I should add that nearly all the reactions I encountered expressed sorrow over the decision to invade rather than the failure of the invasion.
Yeah. I mean, Kennedy wants to hear it, and he gets it right between the eyes. The European leaders think you're not up to the job.
What does Kennedy learn from all this?
Kennedy learns from all this to be skeptical. Don't believe what people are telling you when military operations are involved. They don't really know what's going on, that's the intelligence, and they don't really know how strong the other side is, that is to say, whether we can win this or not. They don't understand it, and Kennedy's view from this point forward is, if you don't understand it, you're not going to do it. And that is a lesson that applies to the Cuban Missile Crisis, because Kennedy could have done things during that crisis that would have sent the world into war, but at each stage he asked one more question, and he refused to be pushed into a military confrontation.
But just so we sort of keep the complexity of the situation front and center in your mind, just we'll end on a note of what Kennedy didn't learn. He didn't learn to leave Cuba alone.
True.
He still thought that he could push the Cubans around and not pay an enormously high price. Now, he's never, ever going to invade. That, in his mind, is off the table. But 6 months after the Bay of Pigs, he agrees to a covert operations program called Mongoose. That is just basically a whole bunch of terrorist attacks against Cuba. So the smoldering and the tension between Cuba and the U.S. continues, and this is the fuse that is burning toward the October crisis, 1962, the missile crisis, where we just about blew up the world.
Whoa, that's a good one to quit on. That's it for this podcast. Thanks for being with us. Visit us regularly for more in the podcast series, as well as news about our new book, the short films, the graphic novels, and blogs by our three leaders, once again by special arrangement. And don't forget to visit us at facebook.com/ArmageddonLetters. I'm Jim Blake.
And I'm Janet Lang.